Time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Iris Chang, author of the book, The Rape of Nanking, and she's in to talk about her new book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. Iris, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Let me start out and ask you what was your motivation for writing this book?
Well, I'd always been very disturbed by all of the anti-Chinese stereotypes that were in U.S. society, especially in the media, and I felt it was time to really dispel some of these false images and depict the history of my people as a history of flesh and blood Americans. It's very much an American story.
All right, and I know in my schooling that we didn't get too much history of the Chinese in America. So wondering if you can kind of give us a crash course on that. And I think a lot of people are familiar with the involvement of the Chinese with the building of the railroads, but in fact, I understand it goes back much earlier than that.
Much earlier than that. In fact, now there are new theories afoot that it was not Christopher Columbus, but rather the Chinese that discovered North America, and there's like new archaeological evidence to support that. But I think the first recorded Chinese in this country, I mean, arrived in, you know, as early as the 1700s and also the 1800s. And, and they were so rare in this country that, the first documented Chinese woman in this country was actually exhibited as part of a, museum display in New York City. And as she would mince around in bound feet and eat with chopsticks and count to 10 in Chinese. And so before the gold rush, I would say there probably were only about, 50 or so Chinese in the entire continental U.S. I mean, that's just how few of them there really were.
And then the gold rush occurred?
And then the gold rush occurred, and that's what brought the first wave of Chinese immigration, first major wave to American shores. And as my book, The Chinese in America, describes, this is a largely male immigrant wave. Many men would leave their hometowns and leave their wives and children at home and then send remittances back from the United States, either from their findings as prospectors during the gold rush or as their earnings as entrepreneurs. I mean, some of them went into the laundry industry at that time. There's always that stereotype that they opened up laundries. That's because there was a real market need for that in the American West, especially during the 19th century. White miners did not want to do their own laundry, and there were not enough white women to do it for them. And so what they were doing was shipping their laundry to Asia, and it would take 4 months to get it back. And many of the Chinese saw that this was a really profitable business, so they very quickly monopolized the laundry industry in California.
All right, and I understand there was a significant push right after the Civil War to use the Chinese in.
Yes. In fact, that was one of the very astonishing aspects of my research as I was writing The Chinese in America, the role of the Chinese in the American South. And immediately after the Civil War, Southern plantation owners recognized that they had a major problem, and they started to conspire among themselves to see if they could replace black labor or black slavery, actually, with Chinese labor. And they actually held a conference for the purpose of trying to import Chinese laborers to work, in the fields as sharecroppers. But it didn't work. I mean, if they had expected the Chinese to be docile slaves in the South, they were very much mistaken. They came to the South, but often with bilingual interpreters. So even if they didn't know the language, they could hire these professional negotiators to hammer out the details of their contracts. And they did often sue their, plantation owner employers if they violated them. And so very quickly, the Chinese, the experiment to replace black labor with Chinese labor, you know, failed, and soon the Chinese went into the retail industry in the South and quickly monopolized many of the grocery stores in that area.
So, was this a pretty big learning project for you and research project?
Unquestionably so. And I saw how really the experience of the Chinese varied greatly depending on the region that they lived in. And ironically, it seemed as if even though the South was one of the most racist regions in the whole United States, it was also one in which the Chinese would probably thrive more than they did, for example, in other regions where they, you know, at various times in history were even, you know, attacked and massacred. And the Chinese, for example, just to give you an example of in this of two Chinese who really prospered in the South, you've heard of Changanong Bunker, right? They are the Siamese twins, the famous Siamese twins. They were ethnically Chinese, but they shared a liver and a 5-inch ligament of flesh between them. Well, after touring the world as celebrities, they decided to settle down in Wilkesboro, North Carolina, where they were accepted by the local people. They actually married white women. They fathered 21 children between them and also owned their own plantations, complete with 33 black slaves. I mean, well-regarded were they by the community, and so much were they part of that white plantation slave-owning culture that when their two eldest sons came of age, they immediately enlisted in the Confederate Army to fight during the Civil War. So, ironically, it seemed as if the fewer Chinese there were often in a region, often the more likely they were to be, regarded and maybe even cherished as individuals. Now, the Chinese in California in the mid-19th century were first accepted when they arrived, but then they soon faced a backlash because they've posed an economic threat to a lot of the white men in the area, the white workers. Initially, they were a threat, I mean, often just to white prospectors. And soon, a number of anti-Chinese laws were passed, and you know, they were taxed at a higher rate than any other ethnic group, while also not being allowed to use the government facilities in California that were sustained by their taxes. They were once even legally classified as Native American Indians in order to prevent them from testifying against whites in court. At the time, Indians and blacks were just not allowed to give testimony, and one judge claimed that the Chinese were really Indians as well, just because Christopher Columbus got confused years ago. And so so really the Chinese faced enormous, you know, obstacles as they tried to as they tried to forge ahead in this country. And as my book, The Chinese in America, will show you, that they, like other ethnic groups, had to struggle for democracy in their own way.
Yeah, hopefully we can get back to that a little later about the rich history of activism amongst mm-hmm. the Chinese. So was it after that first wave that they got involved with the railroads?
Actually, yeah, after they worked as miners, the many, then later there was a, that they were recruited to work on the Transcontinental Railroad, and many of them worked for the Central Pacific to build the track on the western part of the country, and they often were assigned to the most dangerous and dirty jobs, and they were paid less than whites. Often the reason why they took these wages is because the American dollar was so powerful compared to Chinese currency that their families could live like aristocrats on some of the meager earnings they had. So there was really an incentive for them to work in the U.S. and at those wages. And it was very dangerous work, often involving nitroglycerin and dynamite. And in the end, three Chinese men would die for every 2 miles of track laid. So it was a tremendous sacrifice just in terms of life and limb. And what was very sad is that they often didn't get until many years later proper credit for their role. I mean, the railroad executives really tried to write them out of history altogether. They were not in that final photograph where after, you know, the golden spike was driven at Promontory in Utah, and in fact, a lot of them weren't even given, they were laid off right after the tracks were built, and they were not given return passage home. So, as my book, The Chinese in America, will show, that it was really an example of one of the great, you know, economic exploitative, you know, episodes in U.S. history. But to the credit of the Chinese, they also, I think, waged what was then the largest labor strike, because during the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, they did organize a strike among themselves to protest the fact that they were being whipped by white foremen. They wanted fewer hours in the tunnels. And they organized the strike peacefully by circulating a placard among themselves, and they won some concessions. The only reason why they lost strike was because the Central Pacific cut off their food supply, and they were in the middle of nowhere. They literally starved them to work. And during the strike, they were trying to they were looking into proposals to replace them with African Americans, or, you know, or even, I think, you know, former, you know, like Confederate soldiers or people who, I mean, just they were really scrambling, but it didn't really work out. It was really a desperate time for the railroad itself. You know, they were on the brink of bankruptcy.
All right, and then if we move forward to the later 19th century, mm-hmm. They're very key in the California farming.
Yes, absolutely. Industry. In fact, I was intrigued to find that at one point in the late 19th century, almost 9 out of 10 farm workers in California were Chinese. I mean, they assumed a role that later other ethnic groups, such as you know, Mexican Americans would be filling, or Mexican migrant workers, and I mean they helped reclaim the Sacramento Delta area. They transformed the Western frontier into agriculture in many regions throughout the American West.
Yeah, it sounds like they really built the American West to a greater or lesser degree.
And I think people have to recognize that these were very much American contributions. And also, they were valued in the Pacific Northwest as well. They were working in canneries. And in my book, The Chinese in America, you'll see, you know, a photo of a Chinese man working in one such cannery. And they were so efficient that when a machine was later invented to replace their labor, it was dubbed the Iron Chink. So, their physical labor helped the United States, especially during the Industrial Revolution in this country, and helped really kind of civilize the West, so to speak, and transform the frontier into land for agriculture. But of course, their contributions did not just lie in sheer muscle. Later, it would transform science and technology, especially in the 20th century.
We'll talk a bit more about that, some of the stuff that has been transformed, science.
Well,
and
there was a second wave of Chinese immigration that came largely as a result of the 1949 Communist Revolution in China, that pushed many intellectuals and capitalists and government officials out of China when the nationalist regime, fled from Mao's, you know, armies. And so some Chinese migrated to the United States directly during that time, and they were really often members of the Chinese elite. But many more went first to Hong Kong and Taiwan, and then years later in the 1960s, either they or their children would immigrate to the U.S. to study at our leading universities, or to work at our corporations or national laboratories. In this country, the racist quotas against Asian nations for immigration did not, you know, they did not be eliminated from the books until new immigration legislation was passed under Lyndon Johnson. And that's what brought, you know, large-scale immigration from Asia to this country after decades of these quotas and also of these exclusion laws. One thing we didn't have a chance to mention was that before the second wave, for many years in the late 19th century and then much of the early 20th century, the Chinese were systematically excluded from entering this country. And even though they had made all of these contributions, as I had discussed earlier, in American agriculture and in the factories, building the Transcontinental Railroad in the South, the Chinese faced a vicious backlash back in the 1870s during an economic depression in this country. And as my book, The Chinese in America, describes, the Chinese found themselves, vilified in the media and also the subject of racist laws because they posed a terrible economic threat to white workers at a time when jobs were scarce. And it got to the point where there were anti-Chinese clubs and all across the West Coast. And these groups, like the Working Men's Party and the anti-Chinese movement, they wanted the Chinese to be prevented from even coming to this country where they would compete with white labor. And so, unfortunately, during presidential elections, the Chinese became, a convenient group to sacrifice because both political parties adopted anti-Chinese platforms in order to court these special interest groups in Western states, especially in California. And so as a result of their influence, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which meant that Chinese laborers could not enter the country, but certain Chinese groups were exempt from the exclusion laws, such as Chinese merchants, scholars, and diplomats. And so for many years, they could not come to this country, although the San Francisco earthquake destroyed many of the birth records, most all of the birth records, actually, in the city. And so some people could claim that they were sons of the Chinese immigrants that on visits home, these immigrants had fathered sons and who would be like U.S. citizens. And so many of them, would buy false papers and they would be called paper sons. And that was kind of the pattern of immigration in the 20th century, where many people would claim, well, even though they were not legally allowed to immigrate, that they were indeed sons of some of the earlier Chinese immigrants in this country. And this resulted in immigration authorities really having detailed investigations into their backgrounds to find out if they really were the sons of some of these earlier immigrants. And Angel Island, immigration facility was set up on Angel Island in order to detain new arrivals from China and to interrogate about their background. So it's very different from Ellis Island, where people usually were just inspected within hours and just released. Some of the Chinese at Angel Island would be detained for months or even years.
And is Angel Island in California?
Yes, near the San Francisco Bay. And then, and as my book describes, the second wave would then soon come a few days, after the exclusion era.
Did you find in your research that had the U.S. ever specifically excluded other nationalities like it did with the Chinese?
It actually, there were other exclusionary laws, and they've actually, for example, you know, they were trying to prevent often Japanese women from coming here, you know, Japanese picture brides. And so, yes, you know, but the Chinese Exclusion Act helped pave the way for these laws. And so during those years, the Chinese American population not only did not grow, it shrank. And there was a real concern that they would just die out altogether. And then those were very difficult years for the Chinese American community as well. They really were not often seen as Americans, even though they possessed the right to you know, birthright citizenship. In fact, it's important to note that many of the rights and privileges we have as Americans today came about because of these early Chinese American struggles for justice during the exclusion era. Wong Kim Ark versus U.S. is a landmark case that involved a man who was an American-born U.S. citizen of Chinese descent who had gone to China to visit his parents, and on the way back, the immigration authorities wouldn't let him in. And there was a debate that ensued, you know, to question whether people who were born in the U.S. Whether they should be considered U.S. citizens, even if ethnically they were not white. And, you know, to the credit of the Supreme Court, they ruled in Wong Kim Ark's favor, and this firmly established the doctrine of, you know, birthright citizenship, which is an extremely important contribution. In a lot of other countries, we don't have the concept of birthright citizens, such as in Japan or Germany. There, in those countries, one's citizenship is determined by the citizenship of their parents. And so, in a nation like Japan, you have often a group of people who are, they're racially Asian, and they have lived in Japan for generations, born on Japanese soil, but they're not considered Japanese. They're like this permanent foreign underclass. Many ethnic Koreans are just, even though racially they are Asian, they've lived in Japan for years, they speak the Japanese language, they're just still seen as Koreans and therefore as foreigners. So Wong Kim Ark was just one example of Chinese litigation that really helped set the foundation for civil rights law. There were many other examples as well.
That can be found in your book?
Yes, that can be found in my book, The Chinese in America.
Very good. You were talking earlier about some of the activism that had happened during the building of the railroads.
Mm-hmm,
Could you give us another example of
activism throughout Chinese American history?
Yeah.
Well, at different times, the community was really capable of organizing among themselves, or often joining forces with other ethnic groups when to protest for their rights. And that's what surprised me, because I believe there is a stereotype out there that the Chinese are politically passive. But what I saw them doing instead was often, like, for instance, suing white schools that would not admit their children. And as I mentioned earlier, they would sue white plantation owners if they didn't uphold, you know, the terms of their contracts. They also, Ye Guo versus Hopkins is a famous case involving a Chinese laundryman who felt he had been unfairly treated by municipal authorities, and that established the whole doctrine we have of equal protection before the law, which is another extremely important, you know, contribution to civil rights law. And, you know, it's sometimes they would, pool their resources and hire the best lawyers or lobbyists of the day to either overturn anti-Chinese laws or to fight some injustice that was being waged against their community. So another example would be during the Great Depression, white laundry workers wanted to take over, you know, the entire laundry industry, and they had, you know, they use their political clout to get a municipal code or like a law, some kind of municipal law passed in order to, you know, to hurt the Chinese laundry industry. I think there would have been some kind of fee that they would have had to pay that would have just been beyond their you know, their means to pay. And if it just destroyed the Chinese laundry industry in New York, it would have also destroyed, you know, many Chinatown industries that sustained, you know, that gave laundrymen services. The restaurants would have been hurt. All the people who supplied them, you know, with their laundry needs would have just, you know, been ruined. So very quickly, a grassroots movement emerged, and they pulled together resources and hired a top lawyer, and then they helped, you know, or overturn this municipal regulation and save themselves. And so that's just another example of the activism. And many of these many of the anti-Chinese laws I was discussing with you during the exclusion era were overturned later during you know, after World War II, but they continued to be politically active. In fact, the Chinese were extremely active during World War II as well, and as my book, The Chinese in America, describes, they not only did much to help publicize the extent of Japanese atrocities against you know, their ancestral homeland of China, but they also held huge rallies, you know, at the docks to prevent the shipment of scrap metal to Japan. And later, I mean, that they were supported by other groups that were not, you know, Chinese, but it really did lead eventually to the decision by Roosevelt to place an embargo on war material to Japan, which later had some, you know, impact on the Japanese decision to attack Pearl Harbor. So they also, you know, the Chinese raised money for the war effort. That was another huge drive that a lot of people are not aware of. And most importantly, they served in great numbers in our American armed forces during World War II. 20% of all Chinese Americans in the continental U.S. during World War II served in the armed forces. That is just incredible. That's one in five people. And that's the entire population. That's because most of the Chinese who were in this country were male and single, and they were very draftable. They didn't have dependents in this country. They were probably drafted at the highest rate of any other ethnic group.
Probably something you won't hear a lot this Memorial Day.
No, and actually what's unfortunate is that you don't often, when you look at the images of Chinese, when you look at some of the images of veterans from World War II, you don't really see often a Chinese man, a Chinese American man in an American uniform. And yet that is a very important part of World War II history.
All right, well, we only have about a minute left. What's the main message you'd like to leave listeners with?
I just want the listeners to know that this is not really just a foreign story. The Chinese in America, a narrative history, is a quintessentially American one. And the Chinese made tremendous contributions to this country as Americans. And like other ethnic groups, they really had to struggle to fight for our civil liberties and to sustain our system of democracy in their own way. And so I think people should read this book in order to draw parallels between the Chinese-American experience and the experience of other immigrant groups to understand just how fragile our American system often really is. It's not a guarantee. It was always very much a delicate experiment.
All right. Well, Iris, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
We've just been talking with Iris Cheng, author of the book The Rape of Nanking, and to talk about her new book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History.